Hi, I'm Len Testa, host of the Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. It's January 2015, and one of Jim's and my New Year's resolutions is to record a series of Disney Dish episodes in Walt Disney World and Disneyland, using as many of the ideas as possible that all of y'all have sent in over the past couple of months. So please go on to iTunes, rate our show, and tell us what you'd like us to discuss on those shows. Also, a bit of news, we're moving our older episodes of the show over to disneydish.bandcamp.com to help free up space on our iTunes feed and, frankly, to make some money off our library. It's the American way. Also on disneydish.bandcamp.com, you'll find our live World's Fair shows. If you haven't heard those, they're perfect for getting through the rest of the holiday season. They pair well with eggnog. That'll get you through at least Arbor Day. Hey, thanks for listening. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. This is our first January 2015 episode. And like a lot of you, we all have our New Year's resolutions. One of those for me is to run another Disney race. And so we thought it'd be a great idea to have Jim Hill on the show to talk about the history of Run Disney. And I think this is especially relevant for those of you who are running the Disney World Marathon in the next week or so. So Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Happy New Year, Len.
Happy New Year to you, too. So, Jim, in about a week or so, tens of thousands of people are going to come to Walt Disney World. They're going to run themselves ragged, running through all four parks. And this is like the 22nd year of the race. But clearly it did not start with many tens of thousands of people, right? How did Disney even get in the running game, so to speak?
Well, to be honest, again, everyone talks about marathons, feet on the ground, and to be honest, this was more about heads in beds.
Really?
If we back up, the story to 1984 when Eisner kind of came through the door. I mean, if you factor in how many hotel rooms there were at the Contemporary, the Poly, and the Golf Resort, a total of 1,627 at that point, and then factor in what was over at Fort Wilderness. You had the 409 cabins and 800 campsites. So on property, total, Disney-controlled and owned places to stay, you had 2,836. And
2,836.
2,836. And again,
that's it. For the every hotel room in Walt Disney World, less than 2,900. So less than the size of Pop Century now.
There you go. And Eisner came through the door. Remember, he's backed by the Bass Brothers, who, bought up so much of the Disney stock and made it possible for him to come through the door. And rule number one from the Basses was you have to bump out the number of on-property rooms. And Michael, just took that as a mandate. So jump ahead 5 years and Grand Flow's open, Caribbean Beach Resort's opened. The combination of those two added 2,979 rooms. So now you've jumped to and same thing. Jump ahead another 5 years. Now they get crazy busy. So you've got Yacht and Beach Club have come online during the same period. Likewise, Port Orleans and Dixie Landings. Old Key West rises out of the ground. The first of the All-Stars, plus Wilderness Lodge. And
wow.
Then when you factor in that you had, the Swan and the Dolphin, who, again, are not Disney-owned per se, but they're right dead center in the middle of the property. In 1 5-year period, you've added over 10,000 rooms, 10,014 to be exact.
So it almost doubled again.
Yeah. You have to understand that even beyond this, Disney knows for the next 5 years, the building's continuing. You've got the All-Star Music and Disney Institute already, they haven't gone vertical at this point, but site prep has started.
So back in 89 then, Eisner clearly had some sort of like master 10-year plan that he said, if the economics of it work out, we're going to build these two. And if the economics of it work out, we're going to build, the Yacht and Beach, Port Orleans, the moderates. We're going to start delving into the timeshare market. So by 94, they're halfway through their 10-year plan. So they know where they're going to get to, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, they understand that this is also backed up by the construction of MGM Studios, Pleasure Island, Typhoon Lagoon.
Oh, right, and 89, right?
And now you have all these other – you not only have all these hotel rooms to fill, you also have these theme parks to fill. And remember that, one of the things that Disney prided itself on back in the early 80s is they had like a year-round 99% occupancy rate. You know, that was, in fact, one of the reasons why.
Well, yeah, I mean, 20-minute hotel rooms.
Yeah. You know, and that was why, you know, there was so much, you know, to spare, so to speak. That's why, there's so many hotels along 192 and that sort of thing. But now that they've got more room inventory and more theme park, you know, and shopping village and that sort of thing, they begin to really see some pretty wild fluctuations in attendance levels at the both, you know, the attendance levels of the parks and occupancy rates of the hotels. And, you know, this is when it becomes very apparent, like, okay, we can't rely just on the parks themselves to get people down here. We're going to have to create some secondary reasons for people to come down here. And this is where you begin to see in the early 90s, where things like the Flower and Garden, that actually launched in 94. And that very next year was the first year that you saw them test Food and Wine and, it became a formal event at the park starting the following year. And to me, I always find it fascinating that these events were thrown into Epcot because, again, that was the toughest park to get people to go back to after they'd initially sampled it.
Really?
Yeah.
Epcot.
Well, you know, just, I mean, you know, it's this kind of thing that bedevils Epcot even to this day. The notion of, you know, as Disney learned the hard way with the Disney Institute, people don't go on vacation to be educated. You know, they want to play, to drink, to eat. And, you know, that's kind of why Frozen, you know, got thrown into Maelstrom. And another thing that's important to stress here is that not everything that Disney tried worked. One of my favorite events that crashed and burned was Disney's attempt at basically a Comic-Con, like a science fiction convention.
These are big in San Diego and New York.
And Disney actually was among, you know, they had done the research. They saw these things rising up out of the ground and, you know, well, they wanted in. So they announced in January of 95 that they were going to do something called Contact 96, which was this 4-day long event that was going to be held at the Contemporary in both the convention center and its function rooms. Disney had hoped that they'd be able to convince 800 to 1,000 people to sign up for this 3-day package that was $596. It covered your hotel room and got you into the convention. And, you know, so imagine.
So what's the entertainment? So for a Comic-Con, typically it's people obviously selling comics, but it's a chance to do some dress up, some cosplay, to meet some celebrities. I think and Disney uses it now as marketing, right?
It does. In fact, you know, the weird sort of thing is that much of what this was supposed to be like did sort of mutate into Star Wars weekends. I mean, for example, for Contact 96, they announced right from the get-go that Leonard Nimoy and Jimmy Doohan, the guy who played Scotty in the Star Trek television series, were going to be there. Likewise, Jonathan Harris and Billy Boomy, you know, that's Will Robinson and Dr. Smith from Lost in Space. And
Danger.
Disney found out, you know, really fast they were in danger because, again, remember, they wanted 800 to 1,000 people to attend. Only 20 people signed up.
Total. Wow.
So they had to eventually collapse the event down.
The 4-day event. Okay, so
yeah, 4-day event.
4-day event, Contemporary. Okay, so they collapse it down to
1-day event held in Tomorrowland at the Magic Kingdom.
They could all fit in the bathroom at Cosmic Rays.
Pretty much, you know. And people just thought it was surreal. They just sort of walked into the park that day, and it's like, I mean, with your, you know, any guest in the park could, you know, light up to get Leonard Nimoy's autograph and, you know, that sort of thing. And everyone was like, cool, you're doing this tomorrow? It's like, no, 1 day, go away.
1 day. The strangest candlelight processional ever.
There you go. All right.
Wow, that crashed and burned. Okay, Contact 96, sadly.
So I tell you that story because when you start to deal with the marathon story, this was such a success right from the get-go. But again, remember that Disney didn't just get into the marathon business you know, for the sake of the marathon business, that you know, again, with the notion of we need to create reasons to have people come down here and fill these hotel rooms.
Right. That's especially why in January, right? I mean.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, they were looking for a year-round component, which is why in November of 93, they announced they were going to build an $800 million sports complex right at the corner of basically World Drive and I-4. And, yep. And so, you know, 5,000 seat stadium, 2,000 seat field house. And
it's a lovely facility.
It's, but at the same time, it didn't happen spontaneously. It was in the works for quite some time. And Disney also knew that if they were going to get into the sports business, they needed a signature event, that would allow them, you know, to be taken seriously. And, you know, the weird thing is that there was a time in the early 60s that Disney was taken very seriously in the sports field, largely because Walt, had been tapped when, you know, the 1960s Winter Olympics were actually held in Squaw Valley in California. And Walt got tapped to be the chairman of pageantry. And
really?
Yep.
For the Olympics.
For the Olympics. And in fact, the opening and closing ceremonies that we know today are a direct result of Walt's showmanship. I mean, you know, don't get me wrong. They had previously done opening and closing ceremonies, but nothing quite on the scale of what Walt did.
The spectacle of it all.
Yeah. And, you know, and a lot of things that we know today. I mean, for example, how they redesigned the torch for every individual Olympics. That actually dates back to the 1960s, when John Hench, you know, the legendary Imagineer, actually looked at the torch and went, we could do better. And, you know,
what a caveman? What is this?
Yeah, so it just sort of like designed this artful torch, and that then became a concept that moved forward. But again, you know, just circle back on it. You have this Disney's getting seriously into the sports event. We need something that says that we're serious, and, you know, we've got 120 miles of roads down here. Why don't we do a marathon? But again, you don't just do a marathon. Even before they announced it in April of 93, they had been 2.5 years in the planning.
Really?
Yeah. And they knew, we don't know for marathon, so let's reach out to Fred LeBeau, who was the chairman and race director for the New York Marathon.
Okay.
He actually became the honorary race chairman for the inaugural marathon. Likewise, they thought, you know, in order for us to be taken seriously to get the major media down here, we're going to have to get some big time racers. So we should offer a purse. And they did. They offered $125,000. You know, that was split across a couple of different divisions, but they were going for big time racers to come out for this thing.
Okay. Was that, what were comparable purses at the time? Was that a good purse?
Well, again, I want to say it was $50,000, and $125,000. I think they was the male, $50,000, female $50,000, and I want to say $25,000. Wheelchair division, though they were then broken down into smaller prizes within each of those divisions.
Okay.
But, you know, again, the notion was that if we wanted big time athletes to come, there had to be the lure.
So this is Disney picked January, right? When is the New York Marathon? Like November, December?
That'll come into play shortly.
The big name athletes who would have trained for New York would probably be in decent running shape for Disney for January, right?
And at the same time, you had, you know, face it, you know, the Boston Marathon isn't held till April. So you had this sort of trough period where you could make a play for getting people to come. Anyway, to jump ahead here, Fred had warned Disney, you know, that I mean, they're in the process of laying out the route. It's going to start in the Epcot parking lot. It's going to send folks actually through along World Showcase Lagoon before they duck out the back and then run over to MGM, and then off to the Kingdom. And, you know, just with the notion, if they do this right, the bulk of the runners will be, you know, returning to the Epcot parking lot by between 9 and 11 o'clock in the morning with the 6 a.m. start.
Okay. 11, yeah, so 4 hour. Yeah, okay, I'm a little slower than that. That's actually the route that we ran my very first half. Start outside Epcot, run through Epcot.
Oh, really?
And then it was it was the last year that they did that. Then the next year they changed it. But I got at least one time to see, to run through Epcot with. They weren't doing the Illuminations fireworks, but they were playing the music and the torches were on. It was kind of cool.
Oh, very cool, very cool. All right. Well, anyway, so you know, we're still, you know, this is, you know, they announced it in April of '93, and Fred is trying to make sure that Disney has realistic goals for this. They said, look. All right, you know, it's an inaugural event. You're introducing yourself to the world stage here. You got to be ready for the fact that maybe you're going to get 1,000 people for this. And in fact, in order to get 1,000 people, you should probably plan on keeping registration open right till race day. You know, wow. And so, you know, but inside Disney, they're like, I think Fred's a little off. I think, you know, that their own internal, you know, projections, like, we think we're going to get 4,000. We've done our market research.
Okay. They've got 20, at this point, they've got 16,000 hotel rooms.
Right.
They think they're going to fill a quarter of them with a quarter of them with runners.
Yeah, that's what they're hoping. Okay.
That's not bad, actually. Okay.
Okay, jump ahead to September of that same year. So many people, to be specific, 8,200 people had already signed up for the race. Disney had to shut down registration. And it was just, I mean, you know, literally 4 months ahead of time, they've got to shut down registration because they now have more people than they really think they know how to do this with.
8,000? That's like an okay inaugural race for Disney right now. I've actually never run a race with that few people at Disney. That's funny. 8,000.
But here's the thing, just to sort of put things in perspective, okay? The entry fee for that very first race, Len, mm-hmm. was $50. But better yet, if you could prove that you were staying on property, your entry fee was waived. You know, that
you could run free if you were staying on site.
You were staying on site.
So it really was about just getting you in the hotel room.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And
you know what the prices are now for the races?
Don't they start just south of 200?
I mean, it's like 160, 170 for the half.
But that's,
Oh,
I was about to say, I thought that was the full marathon. Oh my God.
It's like 180, 190 for the full. And then if you wanted to run, so now they've got the 4 day races. They've got the 5K. We'll talk about this. The 5K, the 10K, the half and the full. So by the way, when they're running this is just the marathon. This isn't a half. This is just.
No, that's it. Exactly. This is so the
serious
first run of the bug. All right.
Okay.
Yep. And at the same time, Disney now, because they have, you know, at least twice the number of racers that they had optimistically hoped that they were going to get, they actually sent a team of folks up to New York in November.
The now what team?
Exactly. And they're standing at Fred's elbow, the effect of, what do we do with 8,000 people? How do we do this? And, you know, Yeah, and they have to go back and tweak their plans. And at the same time, because so many people are now trying to get in, there are things that Disney had never anticipated having to deal with. I mean, take, for example, Ben Thomas, an athlete with severe muscular dystrophy who wanted to run the race but use his motorized wheelchair. And, you know, and Disney was, you know, again, is very sensitive to these issues, as we've been, you know, seeing with the whole ADA issue right now. But, you know, they had to then turn to, you know, they were trying to have an event that would be taken seriously in the marathon world. And they turned to the Amateur Athletic Association and said, what do we do here? And it's like, no, I'm sorry. If he's in a wheelchair that he powers himself, he can be in the wheelchair, you know, group. If he's in a motorized wheelchair, we don't allow that. And they had to turn around and tell Mr. Thomas, you know, I'm really sorry, but you can't do this.
Wow. So it's not even a recognized category, there is it? I mean, motorized wheelchair, that sounds like that's just ripe for large differences in technology being the determinant of who wins.
No, that's it exactly. Huh. And, you know, particularly when it comes to a marathon and given what people, you know, that have to put themselves through to complete the 26.2 mile
course. Oh, I know.
So, yes. All right, so let's jump ahead now to race day. This is January 17th, 1994.
All right, so it's at 6 a.m., right?
Well, just want to start by talking about how successful this did exactly what Disney wanted to do. That weekend, the resort, every room on property was booked solid.
In January. Which
in
okay.
January.
So for them, this is like, oh, you know. Okay.
And what was killer, what they absolutely loved about this, was half of the entrants were staying on property for two more days. And so,
oh yeah, you're not gonna run a marathon and then hop back on a plane. That's deep vein thrombosis happening right there.
Yeah, and but at the same time, they bring family members. They bring, you know, just it's
your team.
It's this artificial boost that they had dreamed of, and you know, just like they planned, here it was.
And they nailed it. Wow. Yeah, I mean, you bring down your family. I don't know how they did registration the first year, but mm-hmm. typically now you head to Wide World of Sports, you know, the day before your event, and you pick up your race pack. You can't do it day of.
Yeah. Well, this again, that there was a lot of learning with this one. I mean, for example, Disney on race morning, they were kind of startled to see while 8,200 people had paid their entry and were registered, in the end, only 7,000 of them showed up. And
it happens. I mean, people don't train. They get injured.
Well, that's, you know, but again, Disney didn't know that. They were actually, do we hold the race? Are they caught? You know, just their transportation issue.
Oh, do they delay the race?
Well, they were talking about it. They were actually panicked because it's like more than an eighth of the people who paid and signed up and haven't showed. It's like, you know, they're frantically calling the buses and, you know, checking to the hotels. And it's like, no, they're all there. Just start the damn race.
But I got to say, Disney does a great job of getting people from their hotels mm-hmm. to the starting point in Epcot. I mean, starting like at 2 or 2:30 a.m., buses run almost continuously. And they're not the Disney buses. These are the plush sort of Disney Cruise Line buses with padded seats and heat and everything. They're really, really super nice. And everyone's all psyched up. It takes a long time to get there, so because there's so much traffic going into Epcot, and because the roads are so closed because of the race route, it could take an hour to get to drop you off, an hour and a half sometimes.
All right, so back to race day. It is 30 degrees out. The sun will not rise for another 80 minutes.
30 degrees. Man.
And you know, it just Disney thought they were ready, but would one race tradition in particular just caught them off guard, and it just in the last 15 minutes before the 6 a.m. start,
yep.
they just notice hundreds of people are stepping out of the corral and wandering over to the Epcot bushes and, you know, dropping their drawers and pee.
It's true. Oh, my God.
You know, and I was there. I was actually part of the press corps covering this.
For the first one.
You know, and well, not peeing, you know, just but I was, I, you know, I was there.
That's
you know,
a really deep in bed there, Jim.
There you go. You know, that's right. You know, but
wow.
No, they were, in fact, I remember this Disney press rep who was just frantically, you know, please don't take a picture of that. Please don't take a picture of that. Oh my God, don't take a picture of that.
It's nothing really. But by the first time you see it.
Yep.
You know, it's not so much the men. I mean, men, if you're a man, you know, you'll pee anywhere. But the first time you see, you know, women just sort of walking to the edge of the tree line, pulling down their pants and peeing, it's a little disconcerting. But by the 10,000th time you see it, you're like, whatever. Yep. In fact, more of the time it's like, oh, I think I have to go to the bathroom too. So, you know, it's really sort of a psychological suggestive thing, like I need to pee now. But
well, there you go. And what's kind of interesting is by the time the 95 marathon came around, the great wall of porta potties was in place. You know,
ever seen it?
Oh, it is amazing.
It's a technological wonder. I mean, it's two entire sides of the Epcot parking lot, which Epcot parking lot is like the size of a small city by itself, right? Nope. Two entire sides of it lined side to side, end to end, with porta potties. It is this gray wall, and they're all the same color from the same company, this gray wall of porta potties. That it just goes on for infinity. And so the longest line until the very end, until the last minute when everyone has to go to the bathroom, the longest line is like two people. But the most amazing thing about it is to hear the noise of the doors closing. You know, they're spring-loaded porta potties, right? So they have this like plastic-on-plastic slap when they close. And, you know, starting about 2:30 in the morning in Epcot, it's just this not syncopated rhythm of plastic slapping, like bam, bam. You know, it's like bad drumming. But all night long, it's all you hear. It's really kind of funny.
Wow. I wonder if the people who do Stomp have heard about this.
Exactly. It's like if you have little children trying to Stomp. It's exactly what it's like.
Wow. Okay. Well, again, to get back to the prep here. So Disney's feels like they're ready for a medical emergency. There's 14 different first aid stations along the 26-mile mm-hmm. thing. There are monitors standing at quarter-mile intervals. Each of them trained to look for signs of cold or heat stress or dehydration in the racers. There are even cast members along the route equipped with flags that, yeah, as part of your packet, you actually got. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the notion of if somebody was waving a white flag at you, that didn't mean surrender. It meant it was so cold that, you know, hypothermia, that the cold stress was possible. If on the other hand, someone was waving a red flag at you, that meant the temperature was so warm that the runners had to guard against heat exhaustion. They don't do that today, do they?
No, I don't. I mean, unless I'm oblivious to people waving flags, every quarter mile, that's a ton of people.
It is. But again,
I don't know. You can the size of the crowds now that line most of the route, it would be hard to even pick them out.
No, that's the thing.
Yeah,
you know, they're just this is the first time, and they will finesse as they go along. Anyway,
I was gonna say, for, you know, every time I've needed, and I've only needed medical attention, you know, twice, mm-hmm. but each time I've needed it, they are super, super professional. All of them. They now they use bikes. So instead of having people, they'll have trained paramedics going back and forth. So the first time I ran the marathon, I dehydrated at mile 20 between you know, the bridge going between Animal Kingdom and sort of the turnoff to the studios.
Yep.
I stopped right there, and a paramedic came up to me on a bike, and she gave me some of her own water. Mm-hmm. But I was between like the first aid tents. So mm-hmm. they asked me, you know, do you want a ride to the tent? But then they tell you right up front, if we give you a ride, you're disqualified because you can't, mm-hmm. you know, they can't take you. I'm like, no, I think I'll be okay. So it took me an hour to walk the mile.
Mm-hmm.
But I sat in the medical tent to get dehydrated. Anyway, go ahead. We'll talk about that story later.
Okay. Now the race actually begins 6 a.m. Disney showmanship, you know, dazzling fireworks. You got Minnie Mouse and Mickey Mouse there. You've got the University High School band playing. And runners, you know, now begin to run into World Showcase. And as Len mentioned earlier, that this is – they've actually got illuminations running, as you know. And, you know, I don't know if it was such a good idea to do that, given that – this was where the first injuries of the race started to happen. I don't need to tell you this, Len, because you run, but, you know, it's a runner's trick, particularly on a very, very cold morning, that you just basically, you know, grab a garbage bag and, you know, quickly tear holes in it for your arms and your head.
Yeah.
And it helps.
Throw away sweats. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this was the thing that the runners at the top of the race, you know, as they began running, began discarding, you know, their clothes. They began discarding their garbage bags. And the people who were running directly behind them in the pack, you know, would just run up and slip on the garbage. I mean, they had three or four people taken out with broken ankles just in the first, you know, 10 minutes of the race.
It's true. So my friend Mike Scopa actually had this happen to him in the Magic Kingdom. So he was running a half 1 year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first mile or so, you're not really warmed up, but the way the race starts now, the Magic Kingdom is somewhere between mile 5 and mile 7, depending on where you're at. So, you know, you've been running for 50 minutes, maybe roughly an hour. You're warmed up by this point. Even in the coldest temperatures, you're warm. So people start taking off their sweatpants. And Scopa was running, you know, past the entrance to the Contemporary. You make a left, and you sort of go backstage behind Main Street. And right there around where the guard station is, somebody had thrown a black or a dark gray sweatshirt on the ground, on the asphalt. Scopa didn't see it. He planted his foot wrong, ended up fracturing his ankle at mile 6. But here's the amazing part. So he gets medical attention in the Magic Kingdom, right, at mile 6. He doesn't, you know, you're all pumped up on adrenaline. You're thinking, well, I've, you know, it's a twist. It's a bad sprain or something like that. Doesn't know he's fractured it. Has them tape it up. finishes the race, runs another 7 miles on a broken ankle.
Holy
which I don't recommend. He was in physical therapy for 7 months after that. I mean, he did so much damage to the tendons and stuff like that. But yeah, he had him tape it up, finished the race on a broken ankle. Crazy. But yeah, I mean, it's dangerous. And they tell you now, if you're discarding your clothes, to run all the way to one side of the road and throw it in the grass, and people will come and pick it up. They've got staff.
That's right. In fact, it's interesting you mentioned that, because that Disney, from this very first race going forward, that all the clothes was collected and then donated to Orlando's Coalition for the Homeless.
Yeah. And they do that. They do that every year. It's a great idea. That's why I don't feel bad. Like I'll go to Target or something and buy a pair of sweats that I'm literally going to wear for 2 hours or 3 hours, and then you don't feel bad about it because you know it's going to charity, and you don't feel bad about throwing it away either. So this was 30 degrees, so people were cold.
Yeah, and then by the time the winner, a Leonid Shestov, he actually ran the inaugural race in 2 hours, 14 minutes, and 27 seconds. And by the time he made it back to the Epcot parking lot, it had warmed up to 48 degrees.
Woo!
Anyway,
I've read 36 degrees.
Really?
And it's just better because you're up at 2:30, you're out the door.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You're on a heated bus for a little bit, but really from about 4:30. To 6, now the race starts at 5:30. But from about, for about an hour, hour and a half, you're doing nothing but standing out in the cold and, peeing in some bushes on the side of the road. It's, it's cold out there. I remember this one time, the coldest race that I had, when it was 36 degrees, I was running a half. There was this dude who, was in costume, because people run in costumes. And his was like a Sparta from the movie 300. So all he had on was like a pair of really skimpy shorts, and he was carrying a sword and a hat, and that was it. He had no shirt, he had no socks, he had shoes on, but that was. And it's 36 degrees outside, so the dude starts like involuntarily shivering around 5 a.m. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm wearing not only the garbage bag but the sweatsuit too. So I gave him my pants, and somebody else gave him a shirt, and everything. So the guy didn't die of hypothermia, but. You gotta watch stuff like that when you get that cold, because it's not the running in the cold, it's the standing around in the cold ahead of time.
No, that's exactly.
Your feet,
Yeah. So. Anyway. All right. So
they run the race.
They run the race. And again, I can bear this out that they have an attendance figure of the number of people actually turned out to watch the marathon was 1,500. I can back that up. Again, that was the crowd in the parking lot. And in fact, that was what was really weird about being, once the racers left, is just wandering around an empty Epcot at 6:30 in the morning, because it's just sort of like nothing to see and listening to the area music, and it's like, it was pretty bizarre.
And the Black Eyed Peas hadn't been invented yet, which of course is the soundtrack to every marathon ever.
There you go.
Did they allow spectators to line the route at this
point? Well, again, they were learning this. That initially it was just sort of like, we'd ask that people wait here. That this is where it began, and this is where they'll come back to. And
now they line the route.
Yeah, and well, that was one of the things they kind of learned from this race. In fact, that don't get me wrong. I mean, they John's story, that the spokesman for Disney was, just like, this event exceeded beyond all of our expectations. And in fact, they were, they announced it was an annual event, a couple of weeks ahead of the race. And in fact, they opened the registration for the 95 race, which was going to be held a week earlier on January 8th. The day after, and Disney at that point was like, we're hoping to get a field of 12,000 to come out.
Wow. So they've already increased their expectations by 50%.
Yeah. But at the same time, that during the year between the Marathon 1 and Marathon 2, they send out, questionnaires, they bring focus groups in, and they begin tweaking the race. I mean, first and foremost, they immediately take the emphasis off of the cash prize, because this race had proved right out of the box to be incredibly popular with the public. And so they really didn't need the focus on elite runners or a cash prize to make it a draw. And then there's just the stuff you learn the hard way. I mean, for example, at the 14-mile mark in the race, they set out and they decided we're going to – at a point where people are starting to hit the wall, starting to deal with issues, that's where you could find – you know, they put out food. They put out oranges, bananas, power bars, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But the key thing that they brought, you know, that dealt with for race two was entertainment. That one of the things that the racers had come back and said that, you know, number one complaint about the inaugural race was that the course, you know, the course is basically flat.
It is. Right? It's a lot of my personal records are all at Walt Disney courses.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, but so it's not so much challenging as it is enduring. But at the same time, when you're running, you know, I mean, for example, the way they laid out the course the first year mm-hmm. was the course, the start of the course wound through all the Disney theme parks. And then after that.
There were three at this time, right? The Animal Kingdom hadn't been built in 90. Okay. So three theme parks over 26 miles. That's still a lot of empty space, let me tell you.
Yeah. And now, particularly with the last part of the race, on nothing to see roads. And you're just running with little scenery, you know, and hard to keep track of where you were and that sort of thing. So,
And pacing is the hard progression. So let me give you an example. So, the way the race is set up right now, you're exiting the Magic Kingdom around mile six or seven, depending on how the you know, where you're starting and stuff like that. But from there, you run, so you're exiting back behind Frontierland. Imagine you're tracing the parade route backwards. So you're actually exiting behind Splash Mountain. You know where the parade comes out?
Mm-hmm.
You run past there and there's some parade floats and stuff, but then you sort of make a left and you end up on, Floridian Way, Grand Floridian Way, back behind the Grand Floridian. So you run past the Grand Floridian, and you can already tell at this point, that there's not a lot of stuff back there. You run past the Polynesian, you run past the Speedway, and then there's this long stretch on World Drive where there's just nothing to see. And you're all psyched up, you know, because you've just run through you've started in Epcot, you've run through the Magic Kingdom, you know, the adrenaline just kept you going for the first hour, you know, hour and a few minutes, whatever. And then you hit this stretch of nothing. Oh my God. And that's mentally the hardest part. You're like, okay, you know, now you know it's a real race. You've got, if it's a marathon, you've got 20 more miles to go. It's up a half, you've got, you know, 7 more miles to go. And that's a lot, right? How am I going to get through this next hour of running? And there's nothing there.
Well, this is Disney tried to start addressing this with Race 2. So at every mile marker, there was some form of entertainment. I mean, if, for example, in year two, at one point you saw Mickey and Minnie playing hopscotch, or there was a singer belting country music. Race director John Hughes was like, look, we listened to what they said, and we understand that you need something every mile or so to keep you motivated. So they, you know, they just went into the warehouses. It's like, what if we got for inflatables? You know, what if we got? Also, they made a point of reworking the race route. You know, for example, the first year by the halfway mark, they passed through all the parks, and now they've got 13 plus miles to, you know, to just on back roads.
Yeah, I'm telling you, mentally, it's not.
So what they did is they jiggered it for that year. So by mile 8, you were into the Magic Kingdom, and then you didn't hit the last two parks. In fact, you weren't into MGM till mile 21. And then you didn't make it into the Epcot again till mile 25. And in fact, the interesting thing about this route, and I guess they changed it in year three because they found out that the very point where 65% of the runners hit the wall.
Mm-hmm. Mile 20?
Was in MGM. And in fact, you know, that they are just running on fumes. And at this point, the park is now open, and there were people. They're running by Tower of Terror, hitting the wall, and all they can hear are screams.
<You're> like, see, now mile 20 now is between Animal Kingdom and the series. That's so funny. So that's kind of appropriate.
You know, abandon all hope here.
I can't. That's so funny.
Yeah. So,
wow.
All right. Okay, jumping ahead now to 96. All right, those changes, you know, become a formal adoption of it. But you know, it's weird. You know, just you would think this would have been something they realized from the get go. But the big deal for 96 is the added motivational music. I mean, no Black Eyed Peas yet.
Really?
But
they invented the Black Eyed Peas in 96?
Not yet. But you know, every place in the race route they could, they had high energy sports theme music playing. As soon as from the start going through Epcot, and some of it, you know, don't get me wrong. I think some runners may have run faster through the Magic Kingdom because actually in that part of it, they were playing Mickey Mouse rap, you know, it's sort of like, that's just cruel and unusual. And I'm just, but there were some nice touches. I mean, for example, when you made it to Blizzard Beach, they had, you brought out the artificial snow, machines.
You ran through Blizzard Beach?
You ran through Blizzard Beach. Actually,
no!
Yeah.
20, oh.
You ran through 24 artificial snow machines, which again, you know, I think that was only done for the 1 year because only later did people realize after they'd taken a few people off the course who'd slipped just past that point. It's like, artificial snow machines in Florida mean soap suds, you know, and
the concrete. Yeah. And it's, and the concrete is sealed. It's got a sealant on it to help, be able to push water off of it.
Yeah.
I didn't know you ran through the water park. That's super cool.
Yeah. All right. So now jump ahead to 97. And again, Disney tried to stay, you know, at this point, you know, they're serious about the marathon business and they are determined to position their race. You know, again, the notion is they want their race to be seen as a race that will allow you then to do Boston or Chicago
right.
or later in the
it's
year.
It's a qualifier now, yeah.
Yeah. So this is when they actually adopted the use of the champion chip, the little transponder things that you put on your shoelaces.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a little computer chip. It's almost like it's probably an RFID tag.
Yep.
And everyone has one. You tie it on your shoe, and they have these little electric mats at various places along the race, and it'll give you time. So like they've got one after like 6K, a 10K, at the halfway point. And not only does it verify that you've actually run the race, because the chip has to pass over these electronic mats to be registered, but they actually send out your time to people who are following you online. So you can go onto a website and have your friends register, and it'll actually text you with an SMS message, you know, when you hit these key points in the race.
Wow.
Actually, how people knew that I was actually stuck at mile 20, because I had passed mile 20 but not made it to 22, I think. Mm-hmm. So the next one, yeah. So people knew that there was something wrong there.
Wow. Now, speaking of 97, this was the year that Disney decided, okay, we have a success here. Let's expand. So this is when they announced that they're going to do not only, you know, the first ever half marathon as part of their marathon. And again, now it's the marathon weekend. But they also, this is where for a while they trot out the idea of the two-person corporate relay.
A corporate relay.
So I don't know.
What kind of job you have? That how bad it is that your company makes you run?
It's like, I need this memo in Des Moines. Go. You know.
Exactly. I need this memo in the Animal Kingdom tomorrow.
You guys understand about email? Shut up. Run. You know, it's like. But again, just to sort of give you a sense of what we're talking about. They're announcing in May of 97 that the marathon's scheduled for January 11th, 1998, and they're hoping next year to attract more than 10,000 racers. You know, so again, still relatively small numbers,
yeah,
but
it's
anyway,
it's growing.
Okay, finessing continues.
The next year.
Yeah, 98. In fact, that's where it got kind of interesting. 98 was the first year that they began to think, you know, we're going to tie this into other parts of the company. So this was the year where the race was Hercules themed. You know, in fact, the medal reflected that. The runners at the same time trying to give them the sort of the experience they wanted. They rerouted the course so runners ran through every land of the Magic Kingdom.
Through Toontown. Wow, did they really run through Toontown?
Yeah, they did.
That's got to be crazy up and back. That's because Toontown. Remember, Toontown was tight.
Yeah, yeah. And for the inaugural half marathon, they had 2,700 runners.
2,700? That's not even the number of people in my corral. 2,700. I think the first year I ran it, it was, so the first year I ran it was 2005, and I think there were 10,000, something like that. And then by the last time I ran one, which was, the last one I ran was 2012, so 2 years ago.
No.
It was, or 3 years ago now. It was, I think it was 16 or 18,000, and they had started talking about either limiting the number of entrants or actually running it over 2 days because it was getting so big.
Well, this is, you know, and this is where it gets interesting, because again, you've got, you know, at this point, it's like we're doing so well with this one marathon event. Can we start looking about bumping it out? Can we do other marathon events? But, you know, that's a little bit in the future at this point. You know, now we jumped to 99, and again, once again, we reworked the route so we can send people through Animal Kingdom. And then in 2001, you know, they have the largest field since 94. They have, you know, a total of 18,000 runners, with 13,000 doing the full marathon and 5,000 doing the half.
I give Disney credit. They were ahead of the curve on the running phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so much, because I mean they had already established the race. People knew about it, and then like starting around the 2000s, I mean, running really took off. It became the, for a while it was the corporate thing, where, you know, people stopped playing golf and they started taking up, you know, running as a corporate thing. You didn't hear, you know, executives and you know, managers talking about their golf career. You heard them talking about their, you know, their split times.
Well, and the other thing that's fascinating is Disney picked up on the fact that people, families run. It's not just mom or dad. It's typically a family thing, which was why, again, in 99, it suddenly, you know, Disney finagles Foot Locker into being the sponsor. We've now bumped this out to a 4-day long event, which includes a 2-day long health and fitness expo.
Yeah, Foot Locker does a really good job on those things. And the expo is really well put on. It's over at Wild World of Sports. And I mean, tons of equipment if you need it. Really good race lecture series things. Lots of energy, lots of people. And, you know, given the crowds, right, it's still remarkably run. I mean, the wait to get your registration, the wait to get your shirt is minimal. It's really well organized. Expensive as hell, but really well organized.
That is true. And the other thing that frankly, what's smart about the way they do it now is that, again, because you have to go over and pick up your packet at World of Sports, you're exposed to this facility.
Yeah.
More to the point, you know, because they now do the award ceremony on Monday, you have to go to the, you know, the reviewing stands. You have to experience the sort of thing only Disney can do. And, you know, and so when you go home and, you know, you're the group you belong to is trying to decide, well, do we want to take part in this softball expo that Disney's doing or cheerleader thing. It's like, oh no, I went there. I've seen that. They do a great job.
Yeah.
I mean, they get people who've run the marathon for them to evangelize for their other programs.
So what about, yeah, I mean, Pop Warner, I think. When did Pop Warner start? They started around this time, right? In the 2000s?
That's it, exactly.
Yeah,
That's it, exactly. And at the same time, you've got, I mean, Runner's World Magazine actually at this point starts touting Disney as one of the top 10 marathons for somebody who's just beginning running, that they actually refer to this as the people's race, that it's a great first marathon, that it's fun.
It is. It's a fantastic first marathon.
You know, and non-competitive and, you know, and not to say that there weren't hiccups along the way. I mean, obviously, from January 2001 to January 2002, the world changed, you know, that we're in a post 9/11 environment. And, you know, there was an email that went out a couple of weeks before the race. And again, you know, just it was all the stuff that we now live with, you know, the notion of that, you know, you can't, you know, that people were used to just bringing athletic bags with them. And it's like, no, you know, you're going to have to bring things in a clear plastic bag, and every bag's going to have to be checked. And
was that when that started? 2002?
Yeah. 2002, January 2002.
Because I always think of it now it's always been the procedure for me.
Yeah.
You get a clear plastic bag when you pick up your registration stuff, and you, oh, interesting, okay, cool.
No, that all, you know, and, you know, I mean, just it's, you know, the sort of stuff that we just live with today. I mean, for example, that, you know, you had to present a photo ID before you could pick up your race numbers.
Yeah. I just assumed that was always the case.
No. This. Yeah, but what's weird is that you have that component, that you take this that seriously, that this safety concern. And yet, within 2 and 3 years of this being put in place, this tighter security, you then now start to see the phenomena of people dressing as their favorite.
I was going to ask you about this. When did people start dressing in costumes for the race? Here's some of the funniest damn people.
Well, I've got a story here about a Bill Schultz, who, you know, ran in January 2005, and it's like, you know, some people run in costume the entire 26.2 miles.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Bill took it to an entirely different level. Bill changed costumes every 5 miles, all right?
5 costume changes.
He started as Cruella de Vil, eventually switched to Snow White, became the Little Mermaid, which, again, I'm just...
His split times there were not great. Okay.
Well,
he doesn't have legs.
Well, there you go. You know, changes to Cinderella and then ends the course as Minnie Mouse, but...
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, I mean, some of the people that do it are incredible. One time I ran one of my first races. I remember distinctly, like, right around mile 10, you know, that you're running... Again, World Drive, but you're running up this exit ramp, mm-hmm. and you know, I mean, so I'm tired at this point. I had this, you know, I hadn't really run this distance many times, mm-hmm. and I'm kind of flagging. And this dude passes me, dressed entirely as Elvis, with with the wig. But the funny thing is, he's got people around him talking to him like he's Elvis. Yep. And he wasn't running like much faster than me. He was just barely faster than me. So I'm like, oh, I can keep up with Elvis for a little bit. So Elvis and I started talking. I'm like, hey, Elvis, you know, thanks for coming out this race. He called everybody little buddy. Yep. It was, you know, it was fantastic. But just to, and he had the white jumpsuit on too, with the flared legs and the V sort of chest with all his chest hair exposed and everything, and the wig. And he's wearing sunglasses. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. It was dark. He did it. But the funniest was, I mean, so people always dress up like Minnie Mouse and
yep.
stuff like that. One time a dude ran, and he passed me by, he beat me. He yep. beat me dressed as a pizza delivery man. He had, in his right hand, glued to his hand, he had a pizza box. And on top of the pizza box, he had a 6-pack of beer. He ran like that for 26 miles and beat me.
Jeez.
but think about it. Put your hand back like you're holding up a pizza right now and hold it there for 10 seconds. Now imagine keeping it there for 4 hours like that and running. I mean, how do you do it?
I don't even want to think about this.
People are just incredible. The costumes are just, they're hysterical sometimes. I mean, people match, like, they'll run as teams of, like, you know, Minnie Mouse or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. But yeah, those are the two that stand out. The pizza delivery guy that beat me pretty handily and then running with Elvis. You know, you can't make that up.
Jeez.
Let me ask you, when did the charity start getting big into the races? Cause I know right now, like there's a Leukemia Society that's a huge sponsor. When did the charity start noticing that this was a big race? Do you have any information on that?
I know that, you know, Disney, if you go to the Ren Disney site, they are very upfront about the amount of money that they do raise for charity each year. To be honest, I don't have any information about, I mean, you know, it's been kind of a historic thing that a lot of people, when they do run a marathon, you know, as a motivator, will, you know, loop in a charity component. But to be honest, I don't know when Disney got into it, you know, quite that heavily. I can tell you that, you know, starting in January of 2006, Disney, they had 30,000 entrants that year. And this was the first time that Disney actually was drawing fields large enough that they were now an equivalent race to Boston, New York, Chicago, and the Marine Corps Marathon. And what's fascinating about this is that in the month of January, or the 6 weeks around, the Disney Marathon, you've got the Miami Marathon.
Hell yeah.
You've got the A1A Marathon. You've got the Palm Beach Marathon. And all of these are doing well.
They're all flat. Key West has a marathon, too.
Yeah. But they aren't selling out. You know, Disney, on the other hand, you know, just they have to keep closing the, you know, even when they keep bumping out the number of entries they have.
And they're raising the prices every year, too, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, but they, you know, these other marathons still, you know, you can enter basically day of, where Disney is like,
yeah, the original races, but Disney's, yeah.
And meanwhile, you're seeing the sort of the same thing happen with Run Disney. I mean, you know, that's, you know, here's John Hughes with, you know, now with a staff of 9, and every year, you know, he persuades 5,000 cast members, who, you know, that's, they all volunteer.
Yeah.
And they have to work round the clock, you know, for the full weekend just to make sure these things go off with a hit, without a hitch.
It's phenomenal. The volunteers are just incredible. They get there before anyone else. They stay later than, you know, they stay well past the last runner. They all do a fantastic job. I've got this great story I heard from Mike Scopa, my friend who does the Mickey Miles podcast. You guys, if you guys are interested in running, you should listen to it. But, he's got this great story. He's talking to volunteers for the marathon. So let's say they get, you know, or for the half marathon, let's say they get 20,000 runners. Guess how many cups of water they put out for 20,000 runners?
Okay.
So there's, you know, there's like 14 or so water stops.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, all right. Again, this is my Maynard High School math here. I'm going to say for 20,000 runners, you've got to put out what? Maybe 300,000-400,000 cups over the race route.
1,000,000 cups of water.
Oh.
1,000,000. Just to make sure everybody is completely hydrated. Now, it's split, so they do Gatorade, or, you know, they do like an electrolyte replacement, Gatorade, and half water. But yeah, they put out 1,000,000. And they said they start pouring, and they've got this really elaborate system where, I mean, obviously it's got to be sanitary, right? It's got to be sanitized. So they're pouring these things in gloves, and they've got this pallet system where they pour all the cups for one layer, then they put like a plastic mat down above it, and they wrap it in plastic, and then they put the next layer of cups down, fill all those cups, and put it down. And essentially, they're building a tower of cups on the stands. But they start it like, you know, the night before, and they pour 1,000,000 cups of fluid for the runners, you know, over the course of a marathon, 1,000,000 cups.
Dear Lord.
That's fantastic. So the year that I ran the first marathon, my first marathon, I dehydrated. The next year, I was so concerned about dehydration. And so let me go back. So the first year I ran, you said the first Disney marathon was like 30 degree temperature.
Right.
First marathon I ran, I trained in 30 degree temperatures. It was 78 when I ran.
Oh.
So, I mean, there's no training that you can do that trains you for plus 45 degrees. I mean,
no.
Imagine people in Florida having to go to Death Valley to run. You can't do it. So I dehydrated. So the next year I dehydrate. So I get to mile 20. I didn't finish the story. I get to mile 20. Mm-hmm. I'm dehydrated. They walk me to the tent at mile 21. And this is, so I'm sitting in the tent, and they put like 40 ounces of fluid in me, which is how dehydrated I was. But I was so far ahead of, the sweeper, the end of the race. Disney makes you run the race at a certain pace. It's like a 16 and a half minute mile. And if you don't, and so they'll actually, when the last runner's out of the corral, they'll actually, start a process where if, this golf cart passes you, you're what's considered swept, and you have to be taken off the course, and they transfer you. Anyway, I'm so far ahead of the golf cart that I'm in the tent for more than an hour. I'm still technically part of the race. The race hasn't passed me by. So, you know, I'm sitting there. They put the 40 ounces of fluid in me, and I think back to my friend Mike Scopa, who finished 7 miles on a broken ankle. And I remember exactly where I was, like how I was oriented on the cot when I realized if Scopa can run 7 miles on a broken ankle, I'll be damned if I'm not going to finish this race, because I was a little thirsty. And I swing my legs around, and I grab this bottle of Gatorade from a race attendant, and I'm like, I'm good. I'm going to finish the race. And they're like, are you sure? I'm like, yes. And I take off, and I like walk, jog the rest of it, but I finish.
Holy,
all because of Scopa, 7 miles. I remember swinging my legs over like, I'll be damned if I'm not going to finish this race. It was so funny.
That is a great story. Wow. Okay.
So the volunteers are fantastic. They're a lot of fun.
Oh, well, a lot of them just do it year after year after year just because of stories like that, the people they deal with. And But at the same time, because it's I got to tell you, they're the ones when, you know, when they encounter for example, the racers that will do the goofy race and a half challenge, where they'll do the marathon and the half marathon.
Oh my God.
You know, they just sort of marvel at you guys. It's like, you know, how can you do that?
I'll give you a secret. I'll give you a secret. Yeah, 2 days in a row. So 2 days in a row, you're going to get up at 2:30 in the morning. Now there are people that do four because there's a 5K attempt.
Oh, God,
but
yeah.
So here's my secret for the goofy. It's a caffeine management strategy. Okay. So starting like 3 days before the half marathon, I will stop drinking coffee, stop having caffeine. And you go through the first 48 hours are really bad. You go through withdrawal. But here's what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I'll run the half marathon without any caffeine. And trust me, when I say, imagine not having coffee for 4 days, I can feel every muscle. I can feel the electric shock going through every muscle, going from my brain that says, okay, left leg, raise up. Okay, left leg, sit down. It's that slow. It's my head's dropping. But on the marathon day, I get about 6 miles into the marathon and then I start taking caffeine tablets. And I'm telling you, Jim, I was talking to Laurel one time. We're running the marathon. Laurel's running with me, and Laurel runs much faster than me, so she shows great patience in staying with me. But I remember, you know, taking this caffeine pill and some Gatorade, you know, a water stop like at mile six. And at mile seven, it was like running through a waterfall. Like I could feel the caffeine. It was. You know, like if you run into a waterfall, the water just drenches you all. The caffeine hit me. I turned to Laurel and I said, either the caffeine's kicking in or Jesus just entered my body. It was one of the two things.
Oh.
And then, but from there, I mean, I started singing. I remember, honest to God, in the Animal Kingdom, singing all of Purple Rain to Laurel because the caffeine had kicked in. Oh, it's the most glorious feeling. Oh, so funny. Anyway, that's my caffeine management strategy for the
rest. Holy cow. But I don't know. It's this is what just fascinates me about the marathon, those sorts of stories. Or more to the point, I mean, just the notion that this event somehow, and again, just from starting from the position of we just want to put heads in beds, becomes the world's first destination entertainment marathon. It's the nation's largest family marathon now. And the weird thing is they're coming in from out of state. It's not a question of, you know, don't get me wrong. There's a good locals component that's, you know, 40% of the people who come are people within the state, you know, within Orange County. But the other 60 are people who are flying in, who are bringing their families, who are bringing friends.
Think the bump out to like all the other, I mean, to the transportation companies and, you know, the airlines. And I think just think of the bump that they're getting too, that Disney's not even getting a cut of.
Yeah. And it just, the numbers just climb and climb. By 2010, they have the largest participant field to date at that point. 55,000 people come out for
that's
the
what, That's when I started hearing the stuff about, you know, maybe this is getting too big. When did they start the other events?
Well, the weird thing is you see things start to bubble up, just between the family 5Ks and that sort of thing. Some of them, you know, like the diaper dash were there from year one. But at the same time, they begin to realize that just from a logistics point of view, like, all right, we need to put this on that day, or, you know, we have to, the parents who are down here are also runners, you know, we can't have them, you know, I mean, they can't get straight off the plane and then go to a kid event and then be able to run the next day. In fact, that's, again, Disney lives and dies by surveys and exit polling and that sort of thing. And they begin to really understand that in order to make this doable, For parents who, you know, wanted to be good parents, but at the same time legitimately wanted to do this race. That, you know, you got to schedule this at this time because, you know, they've still got to pick up their packet. They still got to get their child registered.
You got to check into the hotel and you got to get situated. You got to get mentally ready for this thing. Cause I mean, let's face it, it's a run. It's a long race.
And, you know, that's when they begin to realize that, you know, by positioning it, you know, again, with award ceremony on Monday, which everyone wants to take part in, and bumping your first event out to, say, Thursday and Friday, And, you know, it's just face it, you don't just get off a plane and run. You began to see people who would fly in as early as Monday and then hang on to the following Tuesday before they flew home because they wanted to do it all. And if they're staying on property and they're eating in your restaurants and they're shopping in your shops, just this is a tremendous cash windfall for the company.
I think Disney did a couple of things there really well. Number one, by putting it in January, everyone gets a new cycle of vacation time in January. So, you know, you don't feel bad about taking, you know, 4 or 5 days in January because you figure, you know, you'll still have, you know, more than a week left or whatever. You've got the rest of the year, you know, to do it, and people can plan for that sort of thing. Whereas if they did in December, you know, people would have to be rationing out their vacation time. The other thing that they do, and you mentioned this with the eating in the restaurants, but most of the restaurants, the sit downs, will do special menus for runners.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll do carb loading, they'll do pastas, which I don't really believe in carb loading, but they'll do it. But they also do the quick service places also do these great grab and go bags the night before the race. So it contains like an apple or a banana. A bottle of water and like a granola bar or something. Just, you know, something to take with you at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, so that you can have something on your stomach so that you're not super hungry when you're eating, but not, you know, it's not like a, you know, bacon, egg and cheese biscuit or something that's, you know, just going to throw up 2 hours later.
No, I guess, but the interesting that you mentioned that the downside of holding the event in January is that, you know, for example, in 2010, they had some of the coldest temperatures they've ever ran the race in. The entire race was in the low 30s.
Yes, I ran it. Yes.
You know, on the other hand, you know, because of the very thing you're talking about, they began to realize that, you know, we can bump out, you know, again, further bump things out. I mean, for example, this was the year they inaugurated the pre-race pasta party. And, you know, that
never went
this,
to that. Yeah, no.
You know, and then, you know, this is when you begin to see, like, when they do the, again, we haven't really talked about the other races that sort of spun off from this, but the, you know, for example, the food and wine race that actually ends with you're back at Epcot at night. I mean, the race, you know, again, this is one thing we should probably talk about is that from an operations point of view, the realization of you've got to get people out of these parks who the day guests, the other people who are staying on property, can actually get in and enjoy them.
Yeah.
For example, didn't they have to bump the race time back from 6 a.m. start to a 5:30?
It's 5:30 now because the field is so big. Yeah, so we mentioned the corrals earlier, but what they do is they group people by your expected finish time. So when you register, you have to tell Disney about how long you're going to take to run the race. Mm-hmm. And for anything less than, like for a full marathon, anything less than, I think, 5 hours, you have to provide proof of running a previous race around that time. And so what they do is they take the fastest runners, they put them in like corral, you know, double A or whatever. And then the next fastest runners are in corral A, and then B and C and so on. And I think this year it was like through corral P. So you've got roughly, you know, 1500 runners in each of these corrals, but Disney will start them all in 5 minute increments. So let's say, you know, the first set of runners start at 6 a.m. By the time you get to Corral P, it's like 7 a.m. or 7:15 a.m., right? And these are the slowest runners, so they're going to take the longest to get through the park. So they might not be getting to the Magic Kingdom until like 9:30, 10 a.m., you know, when you've impacted guests at that point. And you're not getting back to Epcot. I mean, let's face it, once you go through the Magic Kingdom, you've got to run down World Drive, which impacts traffic. But you've got to go through the studios. You've got to go through the Animal Kingdom. You've got to go back to Epcot. It's a lot of time for the parks to be roped off.
No, that's it exactly. And conversely, though, in order to bring in these other race events, they began to have to stage them at night, which then, you know, then you get a whole other set of operational issues. You haven't just blocked off your race routes. You've got to figure out how to light them. You've got to bring in these temporarily light stanchions and things like that. And
I remember this one time running through, I think it was for the Tower of Terror race, the inaugural Tower of Terror.
Mm-hmm.
And which they're not running in 2015, are they?
No, in fact, we'll get to that story, but tell yours.
So we're running through it, and we get to this point where the course has you run across like a muddy field, not a field, but like a stretch, like maybe like a little bit bigger than a median on a. Mm-hmm. But it had rained, so it was muddy. Mm-hmm. So imagine getting your shoes wet with mud and having to run like 10 miles in them.
It was, but and it was slippery because you went from the mud to the concrete, and of course the concrete is slippery, right?
Yeah.
But it was there was only 1 year that they did that. That was that. Then somebody must have told them that this is not the optimal race course. But yeah, but and it was at night too. That was the thing. So it, you know, so it had rained during the day. Because you know it rains every day in Florida, right?
But there you go.
The course hadn't had enough time to dry off.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so that was an operational issue, I think, that nobody had anticipated.
Now, speaking of operational issues, and again, to give credit where credit is due, the first people to pick up on the fact that Disney was not kidding around with their redo of Disney's Hollywood Studios, that Star Wars and Pixar Place expansion was coming, were actually the Run Disney fans, the people who loved the Twilight Zone. Is it 10K or a 10-miler? I've seen it listed both ways.
It's a 13K race. Get a
okay, 13K.
Yeah. So like 9.8 miles, something like that. Yeah.
So anyway, so, you know, this suddenly fell off the schedule for 2015, and people are like, well, you know, where's that race that I love doing? And it was like, so wait a minute, if it's, you know, we can't run through that theme park. Something big must be going on in that theme park. And sure enough, that's your signal, folks. 2015 is the year the magical makeover begins. But
I ran the Disneyland half during the DCA makeover, and from like, was it 2010 to 12, something like that. I think I ran 2012 in was it 2012? 2011. I ran at the half, and it was all construction walls, and it was, you know. It was fun to run through the park because I'd never run through DCA before. But the size of the crowd coupled with the really tall construction walls along the route made for some uncomfortable running because, you know, normally if you're running and somebody cuts you off, you have to run on the grass for a little bit, or you swerve lanes and you sort of move out of your groove. You run on the shoulder of the road, but if somebody cuts you off and there's construction walls around you, you've got nowhere to go but to stop. And stopping and starting when you run is like the most aggravating thing.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, also when you're running a gauntlet of construction walls, I mean, there's a kind of Chicago stockyard feel.
Yeah, you're like, ooh, you're right.
Yeah, you're hoping that there's not a guy with a stun gun at the end waiting.
Hey, they tagged my ear. This is the strangest thing.
Yeah,
the Tower of Terror came along. Yeah. I think that was what, 2008, 2009, something like that.
A little later than that,
but now they've got all these races, right? They've got how many races in pretty much if it's not summer or spring break or Easter, they've got a race that month.
Yeah, that's and in fact, what's interesting is that they split them between the two coasts now. I mean, you've got. That's somewhat controversial because I remember when, what was it, the Tinkerbell one came in and people were complaining that it was so close to, the Moke, you know, there just wasn't enough time between races. But, but at the same time, I mean, Disney race fans are so, you know, just have come to love these races so much, and more to the point, Disney found that wonderful Venn diagram place where between the Disney collector mentality and how focused they are and how single-minded runners could be. And this is where the medals comes into play.
Must collect them all.
Oh, God, yeah. It's a Pokemon world, you know, just sort of like for example, I guess the 20th was the year that, you know, people particularly wanted that medal, at the same time, in doing the research for the show, what just sort of startled me is that out of the field of people who ran that year, there were 95 quote unquote perfect marathoners, as in they had run every marathon since 1994.
Wow.
You know, and I just, the notion of turning out 20 years in a row to do this.
Wow. And I'm sure they got special, I know for the 15th, they all got special shirts to identify them. So the 20, they must have done a heck of a lot. Actually, I had a friend this year, Emily Westhoff, who ran every Disney race, calendar race in 2014.
Oh.
So, so that's both coasts. So she got all of her medals, but, she, you know, cause you get extra medals for running coast to coast. So if you run, if you complete a race on, the West Coast and East Coast, you get an additional medal. And of course, if you run like the Goofy or the Dopey, which is, you know, multiple races in the same weekend, you get extra medals for achieving those things. But now, now there's three coasts, right, Jim?
There's the
Disneyland, there's the Disney World, and now there's a new one for 2015, right?
Well, is this the Castaway Cay one?
Yes. You can't get on the boat. So the deal is for this upcoming one, and I'm sure there are people that are running this that are listening to the show. Good luck to you guys. You run your Disney World Marathon the week of the 7th through the 11th, and then if you hop on the Disney Dream on one of the select itineraries right after the race, you could run a special Castaway Cay 5K race, which is a fabulous 5K. It's a lot of fun. But then you get another medal for doing that. And there's a sign up, so you have to register for it, and there's a fee and everything, and it's not the regular Castaway Cay 5K, but they've extended it east to the Bahamas now.
Dear Lord, I cannot even imagine the level of chafing, you know,
a great 5K because, you've been there, you're on the island, there's trees going, it's the island smell of the ocean, you know, and there's, you know, it's a lot of fun. Let's face it, not many people have run the 5K as compared to being to the Disney parks on Castaway Cay, and it's over in, 25 minutes or so, so it's a lot of fun. But yeah, special medal for that too. And you know Disney's doing it. As soon as Disney announced it, I'm like, you know, they're really going after the people who are collecting the medals because you have to take a boat to get to the race. Mm. I mean, you have to go on a cruise, a 4-day cruise, to run the race. It's the funniest thing. But
and the real, just to bring this all full circle, the irony that this all started because they wanted to put heads in beds, and now we're putting heads in beds on boats. Arguably, Run Disney is perhaps the most successful of the programs. Don't get me wrong, the millions of people each year attend Flower and Garden and do Food and Wine. But, that's something that they get with their normal admission. When you think about the people, what they pay for entry fees for these races and the amount of training they do just so they can then do these races.
Yeah. The investment in time and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And money to do it. Yeah.
And it just now, the weird thing is that, I know that Disney would love to continue to expand this, but the hard reality is that now it's more a case of, I guess we have to look at doing this internationally. And again, trying to entice racers who do Disneyland or Disney World to go to a Shanghai or a Tokyo or that sort of thing.
Well, I've heard Paris is next. Yeah, and I thought they were going to announce it for 2015. And the thing it's perfectly situated. I mean, if ever there was a place that could do a metropolitan place that could do a race of a half or a full like that, it's Disneyland Paris. I think they're actually talking about doing a half. But you could definitely see it. If you've ever been to Disneyland Paris, you know how the roads are around there. You could totally do it without obstructing that many things. But I was really surprised they didn't announce one for 2015, and I think it must have been some sort of logistical thing with the French government that they couldn't get all the permits or whatever.
My understanding is it's part of the 25th anniversary package. That's one of the reasons why. I guess they've had serious conversations about it, but face it, you've got 2017 will be April of 2015, 17 to be exact, will be the 25th anniversary of the opening.
So doing it then.
Yeah, just figure, make it, launch it then. You're already going to have, trying to create a year of excitement, and what better way to help establish a year of excitement but launching the marathon then?
And that makes sense too, because, can you imagine you talk about getting to the destination early so you can pick up your packet. You've got to do jet lag. People are going to make a week out of that because you're just going to fly over to Paris for the day and come back.
No, that's exactly.
It's going to be a huge attendance boost for them if they could do it. Yeah, because you'd have to spend at least a week because it's a 6-hour time difference. You can maybe get over 1 hour of jet lag a day. So yeah, you're really there for probably 8 or 9 days. That's fantastic. I really hope they do it. I will run that race when they do it. I know it's probably going to be terribly expensive, but from what I've heard about the race details, the course. I heard they might run it at night or start it at midnight.
There is that talk.
So I would totally run that again.
And if you need somebody on your support team to handle the croissants and the wine, you know who to ask.
Well, the last time I ran the marathon, Laurel and I actually stopped off at the champagne place in France. We brought our keys with us, and we stopped off for celebratory wine at mile like 25 and a half. It was great.
Oh, okay.
Almost ran into La Cava to have a drink of tequila, but I was afraid I might not run out. Hey Jim, this has been fantastic. This is a great episode and a very timely one too. Good luck to everyone who's running the race next week. We hope you do very well. Let us know how you finish. For Jim, this is Len. You've been listening to the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. Please go on to iTunes and rate us and tell us what you'd like to hear next. Thanks very much. We'll see you on the next show.